have been redeemed. Where to begin? All right. We are continuing with our discussion of Judaism. You all here, anyway, should have a brief outline, but it's easy enough to write if you're listening in. I'm here with some of my papers. We're going to hold questions till the end, unless the question relates to something I'm saying at the moment, okay? But we'll get to the questions as best we can. When we get to the questions, we're going to start off with Dina's question from last week, which I told her we couldn't take because we promised to end at a certain time. But it was a really good question, and I thought that everyone would benefit from it. So I will answer her question to start, and then we'll go to the questions. We're going to begin this afternoon reviewing a few things from last week. Remembering, of course, folks, that the subject of Judaism and then the corresponding discussion of reaching Jews with the gospel is a subject that is much bigger than the brief overview that we're going through. So we're just going to continue to touch highlights, and we're always around for further discussion, and people can send emails, people here can just come up and ask us questions, etc. So, first of all, an administrative matter. There was a typo in the sheet last week that was brought to my attention, so let me just mention that in case you go back to it. The reference in Jeremiah was not supposed to be Jeremiah 35 verses 1 to 37. It was supposed to be Jeremiah 31 verses 35 to 37. So that 1 and that 5 got swapped. I apologize. That one got by me in review. So let's just review some very important terminology, because if you're going to interact with Jewish people, it's good to understand some of the key words and also how they relate to some of the suggestions that we'll make throughout this session. Torah is the first five books, okay? Tanakh is an acronym for the entire Old Testament. The T is for Torah, the N is for Nevi'im, or prophets, the K is for Ketuvim, or the writings, the law, the prophets, and the writings, the entire Old Testament. So it's better to say Tanakh than Old Testament, out of respect. I mean, Jewish people understand that Christians often refer to their Bible as the Old Testament, but if we want to be sensitive, we should never change our message to please the hearer, but if we can be sensitive in our message, we should always try to do that. So if one way of saying the exact same thing may cause offense, but another way of saying the exact same thing doesn't, let's use the one that doesn't. So Tanakh, the law, the prophets, and the writings, instead of Old Testament. After all, nobody likes something old, right? Right? There's not even any old cars anymore. They're all pre-owned, right? So Tanakh. Mishnah, as we said last week, but it's very important to know this. The Mishnah is the oral law, not the written law, the oral law put down into writing. So for about 600 years, these traditions were developed, and then beginning around 400 BCE, but written down approximately 200 CE, the oral law given by God to Moses, theoretically, right? Scholars are pretty much in agreement that they really started about 400 BCE, but the Orthodox believe they were given by God to Moses directly at Sinai. Moses just didn't write them down, and they were passed down generation to generation. So the oral law, but in written form, the Mishnah. The Gemara is expansion of the oral law, explanation of the oral law, commentary on the oral law by the great sages around 3rd to the 5th century CE. That's the Gemara. The Mishnah plus the Gemara equals the Talmud. And it's important that we mention these things because the Talmud is viewed as the authoritative writing and text of the Jewish people in Rabbinic Judaism. Certainly the Tanakh is also authoritative, but because the Talmud has not only biblical references, but the additions of the sages, it tends to carry a lot of weight. I wouldn't say it more weight, but it certainly gets much more attention, okay? So if there's a statement, for example, in the Talmud that supports things that we believe, that's a helpful fact. We're not going to go through the Talmud today. Midrash is ancient biblical interpretation. At the same time that the Talmud was being compiled, rabbis were writing and giving their interpretation of biblical texts, and that is the Midrash. Midrash can also be found in the Talmud, okay, sections of it. And the Midrash is also part of the authoritative compendia that is Rabbinic Judaism, and even non-Rabbinic Judaism recognizes these as important texts in the life and history of the Jewish people. Again, to review, I told you last week when we were ending the session that we were ending with some things that we're going to revisit to start with this week. So again, to review, Jewish people all originally hail from Israel, right? But if we connect Israelite people to ultimately who we refer to as Jewish, and we touched that a little bit historically last week, though everybody hails originally from Israel, there were stopping points before many of us got to where we are. They are divided, therefore, in a number of different ways. One of the ways in which we divide Jewish people is geographically. Okay? So, Ashkenazic and Sephardic distinctions are geographic distinctions. As I said last week, the Ashkenazic Jewish people come from Eastern and Central Europe, and the Sephardic Jewish people come from Western Europe and the Middle East. The reference to being Sephardic comes from a Hebrew word that means Spain. Okay? So Western Europe and the Middle East are Sephardi, and the Central and Eastern European Jews are Ashkenazi. I am Ashkenazi. My family comes from Russia, Poland, Hungary, and Austria. That's where we are hailing from, and my last name comes from my father's father, their side, which was Austria. Okay? Now, there are other distinctions among the Jews, and it's nothing new under the sun, right? In Jesus' day, there were sects, right? What were some of the sects in Jesus' day? Pharisees? Sadducees? Essenes? Zealots? Pedro's been studying. Any other sect that might be interesting for us to remember? How about the Nazarenes? The people of the way. Remember, biblical Christianity. I'm not talking about forms of Christianity that came up later. Biblical Christianity was a sect of Judaism in the time it began. In the first century, it was a sect of Judaism. So much so, by the way, that there was an area on the Temple Mount that was designated as only for Jews. And there was a fence around it. And there were signs on this fence that any non-Jew that passed that point would be doing so at peril of death, because it would have defiled that central area of the temple. And Jewish believers were clearly and historically recorded as being on that area with no offense at all. In other words, the first century Jewish people accepted the first century believers as part of Judaism. This is very important because we share the same root. Okay, I guess me twice over, but the root is the same. Okay, there are historical reasons for the gap that has occurred, most notably the formation of what came to be known as the Roman Catholic Church in the early 4th century, because at that moment, Emperor Constantine said, Christianity is the state religion. Well, you can't, by edict, take a person's heart, right? And so at that moment, belief became inherited as opposed to something acquired through acceptance. Okay, and that's a dangerous thing, but that's beyond the scope of what we're going to deal with today. Now, Today, there are sects as well. Most people think of Jews today in terms of the Orthodox or the Reform or the Conservative. We're not going to go into all the details of what each of these believe, but just for your own mindset, the Orthodox tend to be the observant, and within Orthodox Judaism, there are different subgroups distinguished by a variety of different things, but still all Jews. The Reform tend to be much less observant and much less strictly focused on the Bible. For one example would be this. Orthodox Jews would believe that the Bible was inspired by God, although they wouldn't necessarily use the term inspired, but they see the Bible as the Word of God the way we would. Reformed Jews would say to the extent that the Bible was inspired, it's inspired like an artist is inspired. You see? So they tend to be a lot more liberal in their views, both theologically and often also politically, although we're not talking about politics today. And somewhere in between is a conservative movement, which began as an attempt to maintain Torah Judaism, excuse me, and Rabbinic Judaism, but make it usable in a modern context. Okay? So the conservatives fall somewhere between, and depending upon the issue, they sound like they're leaning one way, but then on another issue, they may sound like another way. Okay? Conservative Judaism is declining because today, well, not today, but in recent years, there's been a very rapid growth of something called the modern Orthodox movement. And because of the growth of the modern Orthodox movement, the conservative movement has been less attractive to people. Okay, modern Orthodox would hold to all the same things that the Orthodox do, but they don't make such a big deal about certain things in practice. So if you're modern Orthodox, as long as you keep the Sabbath, okay, and keep kosher strictly, you're okay. So in a Jewish neighborhood where modern Orthodox Jews live, you could have two people living side by side and going to the same synagogue. And let's just use an example that you can visualize in your head. The men are easy because of the dress, right? But in a modern Orthodox synagogue, you can have a woman, neighbors side by side. One woman would only walk around in a skirt and very, very conservative clothing. And she may be living next door to a neighbor who in the summer is out in shorts and a baseball cap tending to her garden, okay? They're not being as strict on some of those things, but yet still the belief is the same. Now, there was a doctrinal statement put out in the 12th century by a very famous rabbi who everybody here has heard of. Even if you haven't heard of him, you've heard of something named for him. His name was Moses ben Maimon, who was so great in the history of Israel that it is said of him that from Moses to Moses, there was none like Moses. In other words, from Moses in the Bible till this Moses, there was none like this Moses. Okay? Now, can anybody think of something in Brooklyn that sounds like it begins with Maimon? Maimonides Hospital was named for this man. And he's one of the great leaders or sages in Jewish history, yet when he put down in paper the principles of faith for Judaism, as soon as he issued them back in the 12th century, it was very upsetting to some of the other leading rabbis of his day. But ultimately, they came to be accepted. So we're talking about Judaism. So you have to understand now, not all Jews necessarily believe this. But Orthodox Jews recite this almost every day. So it's like a statement of faith that we would have in our churches. Okay? I'll just go through it very quickly for the purpose of everyone seeing that there's a lot here that we could agree with. And all of the statements start off, I believe with perfect faith. I believe with perfect faith that the Creator, blessed be His name, is the author and guide of everything that has been created, and that He alone has made, does make, and will make all things. Sounds good to me. I believe with perfect faith that the Creator, blessed be his name, is a unity, and that there is no unity in any manner like unto his, and that he alone is our God, who was, is, and will be. I believe with perfect faith that the Creator, blessed be his name, is not a body, and that he is free from all accidents of matter, and that he has not any form whatsoever. I believe with perfect faith that the Creator, blessed be his name, is the first and the last. I believe with perfect faith that the Creator, blessed be his name, and to him, I believe with perfect faith that to the Creator, blessed be his name, and to him alone, it is right to pray, and that it is not right to pray to any being besides him. I believe with perfect faith that the words of the prophets are true. I believe with perfect faith that the prophecy of Moses, our teacher, peace be unto him, was true, and that he was the chief of the prophets, both of those that preceded and of those that followed him. I believe with perfect faith that the whole law, now in our possession, is the same that was given to Moses, our teacher, peace be unto him. I believe with perfect faith that this law will not be changed, and there will never be any other law from the Creator, blessed be his name. I believe with perfect faith that the Creator, blessed be his name, knows every deed of the children of men and all their thoughts, as it is said, it is he that fashioneth the hearts of men all, that giveth heed to all their deeds. I believe with perfect faith that the Creator, blessed be his name, rewards those that keep his commandments and punishes those that transgress them. I don't think I mentioned at the beginning of this that there are 13 of them. Did I?
No.
Well, we're up to number 12, which is the most significant one of all. I believe with perfect faith in the coming of the Messiah. And though he tarry, I will wait daily for his coming. And we say, Amen. I believe with perfect faith that there will be a resurrection of the dead at the time when it shall please the Creator, blessed be his name, and exalted be the remembrance of him forever and ever. The 13 state articles of faith, principles of faith, they would call them, handed down by Maimonides. Now, different sects and different people within the sects and different subgroups within subgroups will choose to accept certain different aspects of different things, but that's generally what would be agreed to by most Orthodox people today, especially since they recite it almost every day. Now, the Jewish people did not feel that they should have rules only for themselves, so there is a list of requirements for the Gentiles. So, we've just read the 13 principles of faith. The Orthodox would say we accept, as was stated, every word of what's in the, they say, the Torah, but they would also, although it's not written there, acknowledge the equal weight of an authority of the prophets and the writings. But there's got to be some rules for Gentiles, right? Well, they promulgated the seven laws of the children of Noah, because although Gentiles do not descend from Shem, they do descend from Noah, and all people descend from Noah. So there were certain principles that everyone should follow, even if they're not Jewish. There are seven of these. Seven. And actually, the Chabad, which is a subgroup within Orthodox Judaism, they have these on little cards. And if you see them on the street anywhere, they will, if they ask you, typically they'll ask you if you put on tefillin that morning, and if you say to them, well, I'm not Jewish, they whip out the card of the seven laws of the children of Noah. And if you tell them, no, I didn't put on tefillin this morning, well, then they ask you if they could put it on you, because they get a mitzvah or a blessing for doing so. All that to say, here are the seven laws of the children of Noah. Six of them are do-nots, and one of them is a do. Do not worship idols, do not blaspheme God, do not murder, do not commit certain sexual sins, do not steal, do not eat the flesh of living animals, because then you're eating blood, and the life of the flesh is in the blood, and so you can't eat blood, even if you're Gentile. And the seventh, which is the do establish courts of justice. If you're Gentile, and you can live by those things, you're fine. Now, having said that, let's turn our attention now to a discussion briefly about approaching Jewish people with the gospel. Now, I would encourage everyone here to understand that with any people group that you are trying to reach, you should know as much as you can about them, okay? But even if you don't, there's never anything wrong with saying what happened to you, right? I mean, reference was made, it was already in my notes, this is another overlap throughout the day, reference was made today about the woman at the well, right? Now, when she got saved, she did not become very knowledgeable beyond what she already knew, right? And the Bible tells us that what she did was she told everybody, come see a man who's told me everything about myself. So it's never a bad thing if you don't know something or you don't know an answer to tell about what happened to you. Because after all, we have been made whole, as we saw in the Torah time. What we call Torah time, right? Shlamim, we are made whole, right? Which means that anyone that doesn't have the Messiah tabernacling within them is not whole. So encouraging someone to recognize the need that they have and how you have not that need anymore is a good thing, okay? But there's lots of information out there to learn about Judaism. I would encourage you to get a book or go online and learn about the life cycle and the yearly cycle. Remember, we have a responsibility to reach them, and they're the only people group that's specifically mentioned as needing the gospel, as we highlighted very briefly last week, although much more could have been said about that. So it would behoove everybody to learn more in areas that are of interest to you. However, for those that are not as familiar, I would recommend that you check out shalomnyc.org, and there are certain explanations of special days that you can easily learn from. And we have a list of suggested reading there. But just to highlight a few things here, try to remove from your mind some misconceptions about Jews, okay? Because if you remove these misconceptions about Jews, you are more likely to speak to them. Number one, Jews do not have the entire Bible memorized. They don't. Some of them have most of the first five books memorized and sections of other parts, but they don't have the whole Old Testament memorized. Most Jews do not know more than you do about the Bible. Okay? They don't. Some do, but that's okay, because that's a place to have a conversation. And to highlight what I said earlier, there's a lot of common ground here, right? 100% of their Bible, we consider Bible. Now, they don't consider the New Testament Bible, but every word of their Bible is exactly the same as the word in our Old Testament. The words, the books are in a slightly different order. Sometimes there's different numbering of the verses, but the bottom line is we have the same text. We have common ground. And after all, our faith is rooted in Judaism. Judaism is our root. So we have a lot of common ground. And the least you can do if you're talking to a Jewish person is ask them a sincere question that you have about what they believe or what they do. You know, why do you have four cups at Passover? Why do you celebrate new moons? What does it mean, the redemption of the firstborn when a boy is born? What does your synagogue teach about the Messiah? Questions that you might really have. And you'll have things to discuss because we share the same Bible. And life cycle and yearly cycle are important things to keep in mind. Many people are familiar with what is known as the Romans Road, or referred to as the Romans Road, right? It's the plan of salvation using New Testament verses. Well, the Apostle Paul wrote the Romans Road. Even the detour into Ephesians that's not in the book of Romans, but it's on the Romans Road. And the Apostle Paul just happened to have a lot of knowledge about the Old Testament. And every one of those verses that we're familiar with in the Romans Road has an ancestor in the Old Testament. And so we put together a little pamphlet called Every Jewish Person Wants to Know. The text of this is reproduced on the website, but you can get copies of this yourself by just taking them off the rack or sending us an email or letting us know. And what it is it's just a listing of the verses that correspond to the Romans Road, the plan of salvation, but it uses only Tanakh. And there's little explanations between the verses. Familiarize yourself. I don't think it's too much to say that every believer should be able to walk someone through the Bible verses that represent the plan of salvation. Well, you can do it in either testament, okay? And you know what? It's okay to write the verse references in your Bible so that you don't have to memorize them. And then you just put them in order and you go through them and they will speak for themselves as you work through it. The place where it gets interesting in dealing with Jewish people is dealing with their objections to Jesus. Okay? Now, let me just give you a few suggestions on this. First of all, there's a lot of material out there on responding to Jewish objections. If you're someone that doesn't mind reading a lot of material, the best stuff out there on responding to Jewish objections is a 5-book series by a guy named Michael Brown. And guess what it's called? Answering Jewish Objections to Jesus. Okay? That's the best material out there, but there's many other books on the subject of responding to objections or Jesus fulfilling the prophets or seeing Jesus in the Old Testament, Jesus' fulfillment of the Old Testament, messianic prophecies. There's a lot of stuff out there. Okay, an entire course can be taught on objections to Jesus, and they fall into very interesting categories. Some of them are historic. Some of them are very general. Some of them are based on the New Testament. Jewish people will venture into the New Testament and say, well, Jesus can't be the Messiah because this or that or the other thing. And of course, messianic prophecy objections, which I find the most interesting. Because, folks, the reality is, and you can accept this as fact, and I think you all do already, the Tanakh, the Hebrew Bible, has prophecies that, can I say it this way, paint a portrait of the Messiah. There's discussion of his lineage, discussion of his eternality, discussion of his character, discussion of his birth, discussion of his geography, discussion of what he will do and the miracles he will perform when he arrives. And there's discussion of his 2 comings. You know, we mentioned the Talmud earlier. The Talmud struggles with the 2 comings of Jesus. No, I'm sorry. The Talmud struggles with the concept of the 2 comings of the Messiah. So what they have concluded is there aren't 2 comings, but there's 2 messiahs. And yet if you look at the 2 messiahs, one describes Jesus when he came the first time, and the other describes Jesus when he will come the second time. And as we saw from their principles of faith, they believe in the coming of the Messiah, and though he may tarry, they will wait for him every day, eagerly awaiting his coming. And they recite it, the Orthodox anyway, the observant Jews anyway, almost every day of the week. Okay? And there are songs. There are songs about these principles of faith. When dealing with a Jewish person, let me just give you a few pointers here, and then we'll take some questions. Don't think your job is to prove to them that you're an expert in the Old Testament. But don't think your job is to prove Jesus to them as the first moment either. At the risk of sounding blasphemous, I cannot tell you how many times I have interacted with Jewish people, be they family or contacts or whatever, and I have said the following phrase, forget about Jesus. Blasphemy, right? No, it's because they're jumping ahead of themselves. They're saying, well, that can't be Jesus. I never said anything about Jesus. I'm pointing them to a verse in the Hebrew Bible, and I'm saying, is this talking about the Messiah? Well, if this is talking about the Messiah, and if this is talking about the Messiah, and if this is talking about the Messiah, and if this and this and this and this and this and this are talking about the Messiah based on Jewish thinking, well, you tell me, who can fulfill that? Right? One example. Where is the Messiah to be born? Bethlehem, Ephrata. Particular Bethlehem, okay? All right. Now, that's in what part of the Bible? Micah. Right, okay, now. Do you know how many... Now, are we in agreement that the Messiah is going to be Jewish?
Yes.
Okay, yeah. How many people, how many Jewish people live in Bethlehem today?
Wow.
Take a guess. You can't play. You stay out of this, Papa. How many? Zero. When was the last time any Jews lived and resided in Bethlehem so that they had a child that could be said to have come from Bethlehem? Anybody have any idea when that last time was? 135 A.D. So if the prophecy is speaking about the Messiah, and the Talmud says it is, then whoever the Messiah is had to have come before 135 A.D., unless a whole bunch of Jews are going to retake Bethlehem and start building neighborhoods. Unlikely. Okay? I'm just making a point. Your job is to present the Messiah. The issue when dealing with Jewish people, for the most part, is who is the Messiah? And my suggestion always is establish what the Hebrew scriptures and the Hebrew prophets and even some of the Hebrew writings say about the Messiah, and then who can fulfill this. You see? I'm giving very broad suggestions here. It's the portrait materials, if you will. But there are some other things we can keep in mind when dealing with Jewish people, okay? So, for example, one objection you may hear often, because Jewish people often, usually tend to be kind. They want to be kind to you when you're sharing what you believe. They want to respect you. Some get upset because they view an attempt, keep this in mind, folks, some Jewish people view an attempt to convert them as an attack no less vicious than trying to kill them. Okay? Because if you convert them, then you've taken someone out of Israel. Now, that's a minority of them get that upset, but some do. But one common response you might hear is, I was born a Jew, I'm going to die a Jew. So that's not for me. How do you respond to that? I agree. You were born a Jew, you're going to die a Jew. I'm not asking you to consider not being Jewish. But what do you believe? Who is the Messiah? Always try to bring it back to the Messiah, right? One of the things I hear often among Jewish people is they don't want to let go of what their view of Judaism is because somehow they'll be a traitor to their ancestors. Okay? I have to tell you a little story to give you an answer to this one. It's the story of Abraham, who is Avraham Avinu, Abraham our father. Well, we all know Abraham's father, right?
Terah.
Terach, technically, but yeah. Terah. Now, what the Bible doesn't tell us, but the rabbis do, is what Terah's job was. He was an idol maker. And Abraham, as his son, struggled, because Abraham was righteous from the time he was born. And he struggled with the fact that his father made a living by selling and making idols. One day, his dad had to go out on an errand, and he asked Abe to keep an eye on the shop. And while dad was gone, Abraham took a hammer and smashed all the idols but one. And he took the hammer and he put it in the hand of the remaining idol. And he waited for dad to come back. Well, Terah comes back to the shop, and he has a meltdown, as we would say. What did you do? How could you do such a thing? And Abraham said, I'm paraphrasing here, I didn't do it, Dad. That idol over there did it. Look, the hammer's still in his hand. And Terah said, what are you talking about? He couldn't do it. He's not alive. And Abraham said, well, then why do we create them and sell them and encourage people to worship them? Now, the moral of the story is not just that Abraham proved himself righteous, but the moral of the story is Abraham was willing to go a different way than his ancestors because he knew they were wrong. So all we're asking a person to do is consider what we're saying about the Tanakh, and we're not asking them to do anything more than Abram was willing to do. You see? We get all kinds of different responses, but the idea is speak tenderly to Jerusalem. Do your best to present questions that might get them thinking about who the Messiah is and whether Jesus is the fulfillment of the Messiah. It's a step-by-step process. Don't let them distract you away. And I typically get questions about Isaiah 53. So let me just say something about Isaiah 53. We all know that Isaiah 53 is a prediction of the Messiah, right? But I think people misuse Isaiah 53. So let me suggest to you how to use Isaiah 53. Don't run to Isaiah 53 in the first sentence in dealing with a Jewish person. In fact, I encourage people to never use Isaiah 53 unless you know the person well enough. Now, it could be in one day. You may have a conversation, it just flows, and you get to this point. Use Isaiah 53 if you know the person well enough so that you're confident that they will say yes to one question. And that question is, can I read something to you? I'm interested in you telling me who you think it's speaking about. Okay? If you know they're going to say yes, that's the time to bring out Isaiah 53. Now, I recommend you print it out and have it on a piece of paper. Don't let them see you reading from your Bible. Okay? Now, if you have your Bible and you open up your Bible to read from them, that's okay. Just hide what Bible you're reading from. Not because you're going to trick them. In a few seconds, you're going to tell them. But you don't want to put the wall up before you have a chance to discuss it. Okay? So, whether you close your Bible or hide the, you know, and what you can do, though, you don't want them to see that you're reading from Isaiah. You can close your Bible and show them the binding, and they'll see something that's not Jewish or that'll make them think it's a Christian Bible, and so you can go back to reading. So you can let them see the outside, just don't let them see what you're reading. Again, we're not trying to trick them. We're going to show them in just a few minutes. Folks, I've been doing this for a long time. A long time. I have never gotten past verse 6. Never. Not one time. Never gotten past verse 6. And 100% of the time, the response is, oh, because remember what the question was. I want to read something to you so you can tell me who you think it's talking about, right? So, you get stopped. Oh, that's Jesus. That's when you say to them, you know what? I think you're right, but I want you to see where I was reading from. The Hebrew prophet Isaiah. Now, that has an impact when they realize, wait a minute. Now, what I always say, now, often they get, whoa, wait a minute, I got to check my rabbi, blah, 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 you know? And what I say in response is, that's fine, my friend, but I just want you to remember one thing for the rest of your life. All I was doing was reading the Hebrew prophet. I didn't say Jesus. You did. I didn't tell you what to think. I didn't give you any information to make you think a certain thing. With the brain that God gave you and with the two ears that God gave you, you heard what I read and you said Jesus. Please don't ever forget that you thought it was talking about Jesus. Now, you may have opportunity to follow up with them, but it may not ever happen. But at least you've given them something to think about. Again, we're just touching a few highlights here. And I wanted to include Isaiah 53 in this because people run to Isaiah 53. That's one of the first things they do, and it's not wise. It's not wise. And I'll share more about this another time at church here, but My own mother had the same reaction. I think I got to verse 4. When I got to verse 3, the smile came on her face. You know the smile when someone is answering a question and they think they know the answer? She let me read to verse 5, and then she stopped me before I got to verse 6. And she said, "That's Jesus." I said, "You're right." And when I turned the Bible around and showed her, she was shocked. And it was an impact moment. Not that we're trying to win an argument, we're trying to break down barriers so they're open to hearing what we have to say. So, know that there's a Bible requirement to reach them. Remember Paul's willingness to go to be accursed for them, okay? Understand the responsibility, understand the requirement. Take the encouragement to learn more about them so you're better equipped to reach them. And be prepared to defend your faith. And if you don't know an answer, say, "I don't know." But don't hold your tongue for fear that you're going to not know as much as them to be able to respond. And it's okay to say, "I don't know." But whatever you do know is enough, because we've seen biblical examples of that. Okay? So, between last week and this week, that's what we're going to cover. Let me just take it a few questions here. Let me answer Dina's question first, because it's a great question and it's a fascinating question. At some point during a church service, we'll get into more detail about the Bagel Man's question from last week. But I don't want to take the time because it gets very detailed, okay? But his question was really good as well. It's just not, it would just be take up too much time to get through it here. So I didn't want him to think I forgot about that. But Dina's question, from a Judaism perspective, she asked me a question. I'm going to rephrase it. And tell me if you're offended by the way I rephrase it, okay? She basically was wanting to know, where did the rabbis get the authority to make the rules for what Judaism has become? After all, there were no rabbis when the temple was the place for sacrificial worship, but somehow later on, the rabbis became the heads of Judaism in certain respects. Is that a fair sort of...
Maybe?
Ray, ask it again. It actually is... Go ahead.
The question was, are there any references in the Bible that Jewish people believe refer to the giving of the oral law?
Because that's the authority from where it all comes.
Yeah.
Right. Okay. So, there's nothing in the Bible that gives a reference to where the oral law was given, but they have concluded that the oral law is equal to the written law because it came from God, and they recite every day that every word of the Torah is true and everything that is said from the prophets, etc., etc. So I'm taking it one step further to say, where do they get the authority then, since they don't... Right, okay. So I'm with you. Turn very quickly, folks, to Deuteronomy chapter 17. And if you want to learn more about what I'm about to share, there's a great book written a number of years ago by a very, very brilliant rabbi named Joel Roth. It's called The Halachic Process. But to summarize, here's where it comes from, Dina. In chapter 17, I'll be reading a few verses beginning at verse 8. If there arise a matter too hard for thee in judgment, between blood and blood, between plea and plea, and between stroke and stroke, being matters of controversy within thy gates, then shalt thou arise and get thee up into a place which the Lord thy God shall choose. And thou shalt come unto the priests, the Levites, and unto the judge that shall be in those days, and inquire, and they shall show thee the sentence of judgment. And thou shalt do according to the sentence which they of that place which the Lord shall choose shall show thee, and thou shalt observe to do according to all that they inform thee. And in the next verse, they're told if they don't do what they're told, their life will be taken from them. So, the key is chapter 17 and verse 9. The judge that shall be in those days. And so what the rabbis have said is, God is saying here that the people are to be led and directed by the judges that he will raise up in the days in the future, and that's the place of authority, and the rabbis have concluded that they are those judges, and they got away with it, and now it's accepted. It's completely circular reasoning, but this is the facts. Okay? Now, well, there are a couple of questions. We'll take just a couple, and then we'll finish.
I have a question.
Yes, Fred.
The one of the objections that they have to Jesus being the Messiah is that they're waiting for a Jewish Messiah.
Okay.
That's what they say.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay.
How could they conclude that Jesus isn't a Jewish Messiah?
Right. Okay.
It doesn't make any sense, really.
Okay.
What are they waiting? It seems like they're waiting for Jesus to come a second time, when he'll come only mainly for the Jews.
Well,
before the Jews. It really doesn't make any sense. That's what they'll tell you.
Here's the problem. Without getting into too much history, we have to accept the fact that there are many, many, throughout history, there are many, many instances of persecution against Jews perpetrated by so-called Christians. Okay? Hitler said he was doing what he was doing for God. Okay? And so, with Jewish people and a history of persecution by people claiming to be Christian, in large part, not only, but in large part, their association with Jesus is to a Christianity that hates the Jews. And so Jewish people don't understand, although it's changing now, we're far enough away from the Holocaust where scholars, Jewish scholars, are writing more and more about the Jewishness of Jesus and all of these things. But still, the vast majority of Jews still see Christianity as an anti-Jewish thing. And so what we have to be prepared to do is teach the difference between Christian and Christian, right? I have an illustration that I use in a message that I sometimes preach about what is a Christian. And I say, you know, if I said I was a tree, would it make me a tree? Well, no. Well, if you say you're a Republican and you go in the voting booth and you vote Democrat, are you a real Republican? No. You just won in word, but not in deed. Well, there's Christians and then there's Christians. Now, the context here is reaching Jewish people. So let me make a suggestion if you have that kind of objection. There's a place in Israel called Yad Vashem. Does anybody know what that is?
The Holocaust.
It's the Holocaust Museum. Now, the Holocaust Museum is a building. It's actually a few buildings. There's a few different exhibits. And along the outside of this campus is a path that runs. And along the path, there are trees planted. And actually, there's some beautiful artwork, very provocative artwork. But the trees, each tree has a plaque at the foot of the tree dedicated to a person. And each of those people fall into a category called the righteous from among the nations. And what they've done at Yad Vashem is say, basically, we're going to honor those Gentiles from among the nations, the Goyim, who were righteous, so much so that they were willing to sacrifice their own lives to protect Jews during the Holocaust. Some of them are Christians, or were Christians, okay? And in the Jewish mind, Christian and Gentile is often synonymous. So if you're ever faced with that, Fred, or anybody else, or any derivation of that, you need to say to them, look, there are lots of people out there that use the term Christian that are not Christian. The term Christian means a follower of the Hebrew Messiah. How ridiculous would it be to follow a Hebrew Messiah and hate the Hebrews? But I want you to know that I am like the righteous from among the nations at Yad Vashem. I am like those Christians who loved Israel and the Jewish people enough to risk their lives for you. That will end that debate and will enable you to get to a more substantive discussion. Okay? It's powerful. Anybody else? There's Dave's. I'm surrounded by Dave's.
We have a Facebook question.
A Facebook question. Okay. Is it from a person named Dave?
No.
Okay.
Named Diane.
Go ahead.
The seven laws of Gentiles is reminiscent of what was told to Gentile believers in the book of Acts.
Shocking.
But they also told the Gentile believers not to eat things strangled. Why was that included?
Does everybody understand the question?
Yes.
So the question is, why was that included in the Bible and not here? Well, the short answer is this. For animals to be considered kosher and therefore able to be eaten so that the blood was removed properly, there's a certain way to do it. And so there's risk in eating the blood if you leave it to an amateur, for putting it in a vernacular. There's risk in leaving it to an amateur that they will not kill the animal with, first of all, with humanity, you know, and it might make the animal unclean or defile the animal, or you might end up eating the blood, which is completely forbidden. So the Jewish people didn't create the seven laws of the children of Noah based on the New Testament, but it's very astute to see the parallels. But they went a little bit further to protect some of the regulations that were in place in that day. I hope that's sufficient. I'm sure I'll hear if it's not. Yes?
I once tried to write down all the prophecies about the Messiah, and I bought the Jewish Bible translated to English.
Mm-hmm.
And I was horrified. They ruined every single one of the prophecies.
Oh, the question, which is more of a comment, is that Liz is expressing concern over the fact that the Jewish translations that she looked at weren't true to the Hebrew, and that happened a lot in Messianic prophecy. That is true. It happens sometimes as a defense mechanism on their part, but it doesn't make it any better. So they have played around with some of the translations, but that brings up a subject that, you know, many people aren't going to take the time to understand the Hebrew, but that's a time to go to some of these resources, contact us, get Michael Brown's book, and there may be some guidance on that. But that is a problem that we have to deal with.
But if you want a prophecy and it's been changed, what? You can't use the prophecy? Or
I don't understand. I'm sorry?
If I want to talk about a prophecy,
mm-hmm,
about the Messiah,
mm-hmm,
but in their own Bible, which they probably won't have,
right,
while we're talking.
Maybe. Okay.
I'm worried that if I use a prophecy, they'll go back and look it up.
No, find the Jewish translation that has the words you want.
I haven't found one.
Try Koran, a Tanakh put out by a Koran publishers.
C-O-R-E-N.
It's older, Koren. They're not perfect on all the prophecies, but they're older. And the older translations tend to be less reactive to Christians. If that doesn't work, then send me an email and I'll give you a literal translation.
You can't use the prophecies.
You can. You just don't necessarily accept the translation that you don't think is accurate.
So then I have to get into the subject of, oh, well, your translation's wrong.
No. You show them the Hebrew and tell them, what does it say in Hebrew? And then they'll answer you. And they'll pause often.
When I ask somebody to bring me a Hebrew Bible from Israel, everybody says, but why?
You don't need it from Israel. You got Israel a few blocks away. The same stores, the same vendors, they go back and forth.
Now,
same books.
How do I know the Hebrew translation? I mean, the Hebrew words are actual.
Those are actual. Because they would never change the word of God in the holy language. That would never happen.
And what store has the Hebrew Bible?
I mean, any Judaica store. Any Judaica store. In fact, if you contact the Koran publishers, it's English and Hebrew. There was another one over here. Changed your mind, whoever it was? Yes, sir.
Yeah, my question is, I think when I was reading Daniel, it showed that the Messiah will come before the destruction of the Second Temple. So how would Jews rectify that?
Okay.
There's a curse.
Mr. Cherry is going to supply me with his list of questions that I'm not going to answer. And he's just going to keep doing this. No, all kidding aside, it's a great question. For those that didn't hear the question, he's basically asking for a response, or what the Jews say, what the Jewish people who even have read the book of Daniel, or even parts of the book of Daniel, what they would say to the fact that the book of Daniel does tell us when Messiah would come relative to the destruction of the temple, which is before the destruction of the temple. This is a very deep subject with a lot of material out there, but I'll give a brief answer to that. The Jewish people don't... Now, this is what they're taught to say. You know that there are actually people, there are Jewish people that go around to synagogues telling the people in the synagogues how to respond to us. And one of the things they say is, the book of Daniel was written after these events. Okay? So, it's not really recording prophecy, it's recording history. Okay? But, it can't be relied on in that way, and that we're misreading it. Okay? They would totally disagree with our reading of Daniel chapter 9, and they would say it's not a prophecy anyway, and they would point to other events that happened that's not necessarily tied to Jesus. Now, how to go through all of those points, it's a very detailed discussion. If anybody is interested, I could photocopy some pages of notes that I have, and we can go through that in more detail another time. But I hope that's sufficient for now. They have a bunch of different responses, but they take it out of being prophetic in that respect, in that sense. Now, you say, well, wait a minute. If all of the words of all of the prophets are true, then how do they deal with that? Well, it gets into a very fuzzy area of going back and forth with them on different points within the verses. But it's clear that the Messiah would come before the destruction of the temple, but they take a completely different way of even understanding that. And many of them have never even looked at Daniel chapter 9 anyway. So you have to start from a place of teaching them what it says, even though they can see the words, but you have to point them to the words. But they've been taught, if they hear it, to just respond and say that. You know what I'm saying? But they don't have a good answer for that one. And they don't have a good answer for many of them.
It still talks about the anointed one.
Yes. But there, but for the grace of God, go I. Dina, and that'll be the end.
Do Jewish people believe in the divinity of the Messiah?
No. Do Jewish people believe in the divinity of the Messiah? Absolutely not. They believe in the coming of the Messiah, and unfortunately, there's a lot of difference today in the teachings of the Messiah than there were back in the first century. In Judaism of the first century, in the late Second Temple period, discussions of the Messiah were frequent, and they were cataclysmic and supernatural in many ways. And the Talmud even talks about certain aspects of the Messiah. The Talmud even takes up the issue of Jesus and some things related to him. And they even acknowledge in the Talmud he performed amazing things. However, in no authoritative Jewish work is there any acknowledgement of divinity associated with Messiah. It's a man who will come, and now the teaching is so much different. If you walk up to an average Jewish person who even knows about the Messiah, so there's many Jewish people that don't know any teaching about the Messiah, they've heard the word Messiah, but then there's another group that you would say, these people have familiar with teachings of the Messiah. Within that group, very, very few of them know a lot of the details. The most common thing you hear is, I'm not sure, I haven't really studied that, I know he'll be a descendant of David, and when he comes, there'll be peace in the world. That's what I hear a lot. Okay, but then when you try to get them into a conversation and point out verses where it seems like Messiah has to be equal with deity. Anyway, again, I'm hesitant to go into too much detail on some of these responding to objections because it gets very dense in some of them. We've covered a few of the common objections, just give you some suggestions. We were trying, you know, in this whole series, we're trying to just give highlight information on the different religions so that you have a familiarity, which some of you already had, and some suggestions, but obviously we're happy to speak further with anybody on anything in more detail at any point in time, okay? So with that, if you have any other questions, we'll take them privately after the fact, and then we'll be on our way. Okay.